The following program is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. I'm Kurt Benrud. Welcome to Science Fiction Shorts, brought to you by a team of volunteer readers. Our program will be available in podcast after the initial broadcast.
This is Scott Yunkin reading Tomorrow is Winter by Callie Snow. I hate going to see Granny. It wouldn't be so terrible if Mom didn't stick me in a dress and tie my hair in satiny ribbons. Then there's no chance of a peaceful time because everyone will order me to stop fidgeting, squeezing my arm too tight, breathing too hard in my face, and leering. I tried to complain once, but the electric shock made the world go black. Now I'm more careful. Besides, tomorrow is winter. This will be the last winter because opening the dome stresses the pollution filters for months, and no one wants to pay Dad's company for extra maintenance. The drive takes 2 hours. Mom and Dad talk about winter the year before, about how nice it was, a real winter with snow and everything, and how Granny said she wouldn't go out. But when they took her into the natural cold, she stuck out her tongue for the snowflakes and laughed until she sobbed. The year before, like all the years before, I couldn't leave the hospital, so this is my first winter and not watched on Viastream. Winter's not like the skating rink, Dad says. When the wind numbs your cheeks, you'll feel connected to the beginning of time, to the origins of the universe, to the ice ages. Winter drove humans to fire and companionship. Winter is timeless. Not that timeless, apparently, Mom says. She fusses with her felt-covered hat. Her cloche, she calls it. She only dresses like this to see Granny, and even I can tell she's uncomfortable. But beneath the somber black felt, her brown curls are surely still iridescent. You know what I mean, Dad says. Sometimes if I stir early, I find him outside on the deck, arms crossed, staring up like he hopes the sky will do something unexpected. Granny waits for us near the entrance. Someone has taped white, glittery snowflakes to the walls and windows, to her wheelchair's handles. Granny kisses Mom, hugs and kisses Dad, then holds his hand while I'm quizzed about how I'm adjusting, what I'm doing at school, and if my friends treat me nice. But do you feel like yourself? She keeps asking. How do you feel? Whenever I try to answer questions like this, what comes out of my mouth is, I'm great. So I say nothing. Mom and Dad are cheerful, almost giddy, because Granny's having a good day. Not throwing things. Not screaming that she hates Dad, that she'd rather be dead. After a few minutes, they make an excuse about needing something to eat and go off. Since they don't tell me to follow, I stay where I am. Come, meet a new friend, Granny says. She jabs at a button on her wheelchair and takes her into the rear lounge. The lounge is mercifully empty except for a man with tubes stuck up his nose and a plastic bag attached to a wheeled pole. Hello there, little Isabella, he wheezes before we even reach him. I said this is Grant. He used to be a landscape architect. I don't know what that is, so I ask. Grant looks surprised, then gets excited, talking fast and gesturing so animatedly that the tubes connecting him to his wheeled pole swing, making him look like a marionette. At least he's not poking or squeezing me, or making me open my mouth so he can observe how my jaw works. When he finishes, I say politely, "You must be very excited about winter tomorrow." I am, Grant says. A little flap of skin hangs off his lower lip. A few months ago, I tripped all the way down the grand staircase and banged my mouth into the column at the bottom. My lip did look a little like Grant's did, and Mom called one of Dad's engineers, who told her to just glue it back together. But I know she doesn't have glue in the tiny purse she uses for visiting Granny, so I don't suggest that Grant ask her to fix his lip. Anyway, maybe it wouldn't work. I'm not the least bit excited, Granny says. If not for the family staying overnight, it'd be any other weekend.
Sure you don't mean that, Adele.
Granny folds her long, elegant hands. If we can't have a real winter, I'd rather not pretend. I'd prefer the memory remains untarnished. Grant stares at me, his bushy eyebrows forced together in a thick line that vibrates with his breathing.
What do you think, Isabella? Would you rather have gone away forever lost, or do you prefer these added moments of reunion?
Grant, Granny says, her voice sharp, and I wonder if she's now having a bad day, if it's going to start right in front of me. Grant mumbles an apology. When I first got sick, my parents took away my dolls and replaced them with easily sterilized metal toys. Birthdays, I had to watch Mom open my presents on ViaStream. I hated that. My friends didn't visit often. They didn't like the glass wall. Lana said I was so skinny and pale that with my bald head I looked like a skeleton. Moments of reunion. The words are strange in my mouth because it's the opposite the answer I wanted to give. An electric shock zaps through me. Luckily, that happens less and less often as I learn what to say and feel. The floor trembles, just like Dad said it would. The new safety locks around the top of the dome are being tested.
You poor thing! My son's a sentimental fool!
Granny leans back in her chair, suddenly distant. I don't think she knows that I can hear her processors whirring. I'm not even sure she's aware of them, but I can't find a way to ask.
This is Renita Banerjee. The story that I'm about to read is titled How Long is a Time Loop? By H. Burford Reed. So what exactly is a time loop? I ask, on a wet winter's night as I take my shoes off and recline on the professor's sofa. Again, Father? I hold back a sigh as he speaks. It has become harder to talk with him over the last few months. Instead, I nod and smile eagerly. Sitting down next to me, he speaks in a patient tone. Time repeating itself, conceivably, forever. Nobody knows what one would remember between the ending and starting of each loop, or whether it's even possible. He looks at me, and in his old eyes, I see myself. I see pity. You never did get around to telling me where you got that, Professor Tony, I say, breaking eye contact and pointing to the large grandfather clock across his dark room. The second hand ticks forward twice and backwards thrice. His head swivels around and I instantly regret the change of subject. With just a scratch of his cheek, I can see his confusion. You bought it for me about 25 years ago when you went to Devon? I stay silent as he stands and admires the clock. When Jess told me about his dementia, I didn't realize he would get me confused with someone. I always thought it would be close family members, not students, not distant friends, not me. The clock strikes 10 and thunder rolls across the sky. He turns and grasps my hands with a fierce tightness, one I would not expect from a man so old. We'll speak tomorrow, Father. He speaks in a hushed tone as if not wanting a lurking figure to hear him. I awake in a hospital bed. Slowly I find my glasses before looking about the room. I'm partially reassured by the sight of the old grandfather clock. The second hand ticks forward twice and backwards thrice. I try to leave the bed, but I feel too tired despite just waking up. The door opens and a young man walks in, carrying a stack of boxes filled with pastries. The stranger greets me then, places the boxes on the table at the end of the bed. Did you come with Jess? I ask, yet don't know why I expect him to know who she is. No, you know, you must remember at least that. I shake my head slightly, not enough for him to see, and scratch my cheek. Is she helping her father today? You know, he gets awfully confused. I was talking to him yesterday night. I hear him sigh as he sits on the edge of the bed. You didn't have any visitors yesterday, especially not from him. I stare at him. Granddad's been dead for decades. Who are you? My voice is now faint. Something in the air irritates my eye and I try to wipe it. More importantly, why am I here? I'm going to be late. I try again to stand, but my legs don't move well enough. I fall to the ground, hearing a thud and seeing black. I wake up again, this time sitting on the sofa next to the rigid bed. The stranger is kneeling, grasping my hands. I look away. The clock ticks backwards again, and I see it strike 10. Thunder cracks. I notice he wants to speak, but I start before him. How long does a time loop last? I look into his eyes and see them sink. Again, Father? Conceivably forever. He glances at his watch. We'll speak tomorrow, Father. I awake in a hospital bed and feel familiar. Somewhere in the back of my mind, something rings. I look around the room, but without my glasses, all I recognize is the grandfather clock. The second hand ticks forward twice and backwards thrice. I wish Tony could see it. He'd have found it funnier than Abbott and Costello. Through the thin walls, I hear the familiar step of the professor. The door opens and the professor walks in carrying a stack of boxes. Without my glasses, I can't tell what's in them. Then something hits my mind again and I have an urge to ask a question I'd never thought of before. Professor, what exactly is a time loop?
Eric Benrud. The title is The Immortal and the Time Traveler by Victoria Zelvin. Stop following me, the time traveler says upon finding the immortal again and again. I was here first, the immortal says, every time. How did you become immortal anyway, the time traveler asks, only once there's no color left in their hair. The first time the question is asked to the immortal, they are young. So young, their immortality is like a raw wound, still bleeding. Must we discuss mortality? The time traveler makes a face. Nothing lasts, except for you. They leave without goodbye. After finding one another again, there is a table, two chairs, and a bottle of something strong between them. No matter where the conversation starts, it manages to linger beyond the first few sentences it returns to the same place. History and art. The time traveler has a fine appreciation for history. The immortal has a fine appreciation for art. Their semi-cordial disagreement over the importance of the topics goes back centuries. They discuss it mainly at their middle age, both with experiences notched in their belts. History is more important than art, the time traveler insists. Big moments that shape the course of mankind. The immortal huffs. How do you think the big moments happen without the little ones to give context to what comes next? The time traveler goes back to when man lived in caves. They set the time machine to scan for biological matter and find a child playing with sticks by a riverside in the way children do across time. They watch for minutes before typing into the machine latched to their forearm like a macabre watch, scanning. There must be an answer here. The child notices them and walks up without fear, like greeting an old friend. The time traveler cannot shake them, no matter how fast they walk. "What are you doing?" the child asks. "Stop following me," the time traveler snaps. The child blinks in owlish confusion. I was here first. You should stop and look once in a while, the immortal suggests from time to time. This time it's to a young time traveler, one with a fresh smile and wider eyes. You mean years? A life, not a trip? The time traveler replies. The immortal only inclines their head mutely while the time traveler starts to fidget. There's no time. Not all of us are immortal. How many moments must you collect like trading cards before you're satisfied? How many times must you make the argument? At least once more, my friend, as always. How did you become immortal anyway? The time traveler asks again, sharp. The immortal is old, so old their immortality is like a faded scar, sometimes aching but mainly remembered in stories. Must we discuss immortality? Nothing it lasts, except for you. You're going to die, the immortal tells the time traveler. It makes the time traveler wince. But the immortal continues. You are going to fade. Nothing will stop that. Even my memories of you will not keep you alive. For if I tell someone of you, they'll lack the context to understand. It is inevitable. The time traveler opens and closes their mouth several times. They lift their hand, jab a finger in the air between them, heave their chest as if they make some bold proclamation, but all they can conjure is a muted, neutered, "You're a bastard, you know that?" "I merely said that you're going to die, old friend," the immortal says. "Not that you live for nothing." The time traveler leaves without goodbye. From time to time, the time traveler goes back to that child playing by the river. Sometimes they watch from afar, scanning the places the child likes to go, and then the teenager, and then the adult. The time traveler wonders if the immortal remembers them from childhood, wonders if that's why the immortal approaches their younger self in the first place, but sees no harm in continuing to look. Why are they immortal? Surely if it's a secret, the time traveler can find it. Big moment, says the time traveler. Little moment, says the immortal. The time traveler gets older and stops caring about the sanctity of their timeline. They flit from a meeting in 1420 to one in 4120. It is increasingly hard for the immortal to keep track of what they talked of last and when they'd meet before, of what the mood the time traveler is likely to be in. "I don't want there to be a last time you see me," the time traveler says once in the 3270s. "There's always going to be a last time," the immortal says, morose. "You shouldn't use that thing so much. I've been reading it's dangerous." "Shows what you know," the time traveler says, a ghost of their former youthful hothead self. "Is this before or after?" The immortal can't tell and dare not ask. There is a child playing in the park. They've got a spaceship in their hand. They're making whooshing sounds if they run down the path towards... Perhaps it's coincidence that the immortal, old and frail, is struggling down that same path to the lakeshore. The child does not think so and turns around with a scowl. "Stop following me," the child demands. "I was here first," the immortal tells them, a sad smile on their face. The child pouts. "Nuh-uh," the immortal smiles. The time traveler's not getting older in their visits. The immortal's afraid to comment on it. The time traveler's been a constant companion. The immortal has grown reliant on their visits amid so much death, so much loss. Has the immortal lost them too? The time traveler alone suspected that becoming immortal was a big moment, a lightning strike. The time traveler even hung around the immortal's mother during the pregnancy. All in all, the time traveler visits the immortal as a fetus, a baby, a child, a teenager, more than 600 times. Members of the immortal's tribe think of the time traveler as a traitor. No other woman gets pregnant during this time. No other children are born. Then, when the immortal is still young, members of the tribe start to die off. Not odd at first, as it is in pre-city's ancient times. But the time traveler scans the dozens to die and discovers a cancer these people shouldn't have yet, the same cancer that is strangling the time traveler from the inside out. It's the radiation leaking from their long, antiquated time machine. The time traveler realizes with dawning horror. They've killed these people, orphaned the immortal, made the immortal through some fluke. 600 little moments adding up to one when the immortal takes an arrow to the heart, then gets back up, bewildered. It makes the time traveler vomit. The time traveler takes the immortal from their tribe when no one is left, makes sure that they get to a farm and pays the family to care for them, and does not visit any version of the immortal again for some time. 3,787 years after the time traveler storms out for the second time, the immortal comes home to a dusty book with papyrus pages. It's written in a language the immortal knew once but has long since forgotten, and has a note. "Remember you mentioning it was one of your favorites." The immortal smiles and runs a hand over the pages, reminiscing without reading, trying to imagine what sort of story was within that must have captured their imagination enough to mention it to the time traveler. Is this before or after the time traveler knows? How did you become immortal anyway? The time traveler asks again, fear wrapped about their voice like a thorny vine. The last time the question is asked to the immortal, they are old, frail. No longer mobile on their own, dying. Nothing lasts forever. Must we discuss mortality? Nothing lasts except for you? Heh, I'm not lasting much longer. So, good and tired. The time traveler fidgets. I'm sorry, did you always? The immortal raises a hand, shushes them, and gestures at the floor. It's been so long that the immortal cares not for attempted apologies. They sit down beside their friend's wheelchair, face towards the looking glass. There is no more life on Earth, not anymore. Something to do with the sun, something to do with the ozone layer, something the time traveler never bothered to learn about. But humanity can still watch storms swirl across the continents the time traveler cannot recognize from space stations. Stars glitter around it, and the time traveler doesn't have any context for this moment. It's too far in the future. But when they look up at the immortal, their eyes are shut, and so the time traveler huffs out a small sigh. It's not a bad place to rest, to die. Okay, they say. Maybe you did have a point.
I'm Melanie Simmons. This story is titled The Subatomic Fiber Optic Deconstruction/Construction Transportation Chamber by Dylan Otto Kreider. Would you like to be the first to climb onto the device? Would you proceed if you fully understood the scientific principles upon which it is based? What is it about the device that troubles you? Is it the flashy lights on the control panel? The eerie hum of the machine as it powers up? Is it the slight nod of the technician inviting you to step on as he stands safely behind shatter-resistant plexiglass? Or is it the strange glow of the mist that swirls about the chamber you have just agreed to enter? That is, if you're still committed to this project, if you haven't decided to back out. Perhaps your reservations come from the knowledge that this strange glowing mist is no mist at all, neither vapor nor gas, but metal, trillions of microscopic robots perched and waiting for your atoms to come within range. Though its technology is complex, its function is simple. A computer pulls apart your atoms one by one, logging their exact locations into its memory banks, before sending the information over a fiber optics cable to another device, identical to the first, which simultaneously reconstructs you, atom by atom, molecule by molecule. If you stepped into the subatomic fiber optic deconstruction/construction transportation platform located, say, in your living room, and were sent across the country, beneath the ocean to another continent, if it reproduced you precisely down to the molecular level in some office, say, in Greenland or Cairo, what difference would there be? What variation could possibly exist? The conclusion is difficult to avoid. It is you, exactly, atom for atom. So what is it that bothers you about this new ability to travel with the ease of a fax or a phone call? Why would you pass up the opportunity to cruise at the speed of light? Could you possibly sneer at an 8-minute commute to the sun with a 4.7-millisecond pit stop at a communications satellite? But that's not really the way it happens, is it? You're not transported so much as Xeroxed, an exact duplicate of the New York you molded in Egypt. But it is you in all the ways that matter. That's you there in the subatomic fiber optic deconstruction/construction transportation chamber, your genes, your body, your brain and memories, atom for atom. It's you in every way, every aspect save one. It's not your atoms. Your atoms are back home in storage, reduced to $15 worth of calcium, carbon, and tap water, with a sprinkle of phosphorus. Your oxygen has dissipated. The subatomic fiber optic deconstruction/construction transportation chamber will have to pull that from the air when you return. You are now the cost of a movie ticket or lunch at a moderately priced downtown restaurant, including drink, tip, and modest dessert. You are carrying someone else's carbon and calcium and tap water with a touch of phosphorus and oxygen pulled straight from the air. Perhaps the one who used the fiber optic deconstruction/construction transportation device before you. If you weren't the first, a test pilot wanting to make the history books. So the question becomes the difference between any two atoms. Does knowing that the atoms in your body at this moment are not the same ones that were there a mere month ago make it any easier to climb aboard? Does the understanding that you are a constantly changing, evolving machine, adding and replacing its atoms as a normal par for the course with every meal? Do atoms vary in their ability, size, or quality? Does every atom have its own particular eccentricities, personality? This isn't necessarily a consolation as you hear the hiss of the subatomic fiber optic deconstruction / construction transportation chamber door and step upon the subatomic fiber optic deconstruction / construction platform into the strange metallic subatomic mist. After all, it is you that is in the chamber, you who will be torn apart, who will be reduced to a few buckets of murky water. Even though it is you in the desert on the other side of the world in every way that matters to the universe, being torn apart matters to you, the you that is here, now, for that brief instant before you do not exist, except as a flow of photons through a fiber optics wire. The difference is not physical. You may be looking in the wrong place. It matters in the realm of the psychological, the theological, the metaphysical. Perhaps what bothers you is that you'd like to believe there is something more to you beyond your atomic makeup that can't be transported or copied by a deconstruction / construction transportation device. If the device works, then what makes you you is not even the atoms or the things that make you solid and material. You're merely an arrangement, a collection of locations and movements that make up your mind, body, and memories. Like music, you exist not in the molecules themselves, but the sound waves that travel through them, manipulating each set of atoms for a brief time before moving on. But a pluck of the string, a vibration in space-time that plays its one note before fading. Complex? Yes. Sophisticated? Even more so. But vibrations, nothing more, regardless of which matter you choose to move yourself through. It's not too late. You still have time to step off the subatomic fiber optic deconstruction / construction transportation device. No one will think less of you. No one has to know. But you hear voices outside the chamber. Has someone come to rescue you? To stop you before it's too late? But they are happy voices. Voices of applause and congratulation as the door begins to open and you realize they are speaking Arabic. Then any doubts about the machine's effectiveness are forgotten, along with your fears of glitches and malfunctions. One for the records. You've made history. So what is it that disturbs you now? Is it that the device works?
You've been listening to Science Fiction Shorts on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Kurt Benrud. My team of volunteer readers and I thank you for listening in. And we would love to have you join us next time. Just a quick reminder, this program is available in podcast, and it is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. As always, our number is 832-5138, and that's 919-832-5138. If you're a fan of sci-fi and have something to say, we want to hear from you.